This podcast was recorded in November 2016, just after reports from the Audit Office and CQC about the quality of services in social care.
Welcome to Helpful Social Work. Social work has the power to change people's lives for the better. This podcast aims to help you learn, think, and act with integrity so that people who need social work get help that will transform their lives. Hi, I'm Jerry.
And I'm Jo. In this podcast, we'll be continuing to look at how we relate to colleagues at work. Specifically, we're looking at the challenging area of challenge. Now, the International Federation of Social Workers' Codes of Ethics actually expects this from us. They say social workers should foster and engage in ethical debate with their colleagues and employers and take responsibility for making ethically informed decisions. It is part of our code of ethics.
And it does relate closely to anti-oppressive practice, which I'm not sure is talked about all that much anymore. But when I started in social work, I had a really good team manager who was very reassuring to me as a newly qualified social worker. And her supervision, I always remember as being excellent because she had on the agenda every time we met anti-oppressive practice as a topic to talk about. And she would talk about any experiences I had of oppression, any oppression I'd been part of or witnessed, any issues around power within the organisation or with other professionals or particularly with service users and carers. And quite early on in my career, I was about 3 months qualified, I made quite a big mistake and actually arranged for somebody to go home from hospital without letting anybody know that they were coming home. So there was nobody there, so they had to come back in, and that preempted a big critical incident because it threw all the planning for the ward. And I was kind of hauled in, and I was really scared, obviously, that I'd made this mistake and it was going to affect my career and I'd fail somebody. And because I trusted my supervisor, she was able to help me to unpick the mistake and to learn from it without me feeling as if I was being challenged in an oppressive way or in a powerful way, because we had that trusting relationship. So I suppose that's one of the things that really strikes me about challenge, is that it has to be done with a real consciousness of power.
And it's really great, isn't it, Jerry, that you can have those positive experiences of being challenged well early in your career, because it really does set an expectation around challenge that it is going to be helpful and supportive. Mm. I think part of having integrity is about being prepared to challenge things that we're not sure about or that concern us. And this is part of the support we provide to colleagues. And that story really highlights the fact that she was providing that support to you. But I think challenge is a really difficult word, isn't it? It has negative implications. And often, when we talk about it, we talk about that word discovery as what we're actually trying to do with challenge is to increase our knowledge and ability to act effectively. And there's a real spectrum to that idea of challenge or discovery, and it ranges from questioning through to whistleblowing, really. And how we try to discover will depend on the reaction of people around us. Challenge can be seen as negative and disloyal, and it can be really difficult and lonely. However, if we build expectations of constructive challenge as a norm, it does get easier and more positive. And I think one of the really key things here is about being curious and asking questions of everyone, and at all times having a good beginning. You know, it's that kind of expectation, isn't it, that other people want to do a good job?
Yeah.
And that if they haven't done a good job, there'll be a reason for it. And so actually being curious about that and trying to encourage people to reflect on their own behaviours.
Yeah, and challenging people is stressful. I think it's one of the most difficult things that you can do. So we need to be practiced at asking questions and being curious and before anything goes wrong. And one of the things we talk about quite a lot is the reflective cycle as a helpful tool for thinking through what's happening and how you're feeling about it and what it means and what you're going to do, always, not just in reflective supervision, but always. And the reflective cycle is also really helpful for challenging people, because what you're trying to find out is, where are people stuck? What is it that's stopping them from acting in a thoughtful, purposeful, helpful way? And we talk as well about people gravitating towards the things that they like and the things that they're good at. And that can lead to you neglecting an area of your practice. So, for example, people who like to act may not reflect as much. People who are very emotionally aware may get stuck in the emotional element. So what you can do with the reflective cycle is that if you notice that someone is acting in a way that's not helpful, then you can try to understand where they've got to in the cycle. So are they preoccupied with what's happened? Are they preoccupied with how they feel or what they think about it? Or are they preoccupied with trying to do things? And peers, mentors, supervisors can all help to identify our blind spots. So again, it's about practicing before you need to challenge. And that's that sort of challenge, that kind of constructive, helpful learning challenge is quite different from the sort of challenge that you might need when someone's actually acting oppressively or they're bullying or acting unethically. And that's a particularly difficult, those kind of areas are particularly difficult to challenge because there's often power imbalances and painful emotions involved. And whistleblowing may be needed actually if the bullying or the issue, the ethical issue, extends to the culture. So you can't challenge effectively through your normal structures, going to your supervisor, going to their supervisor. And I think there is a real impact that can happen from good role models, whether that's the manager or an experienced practitioner or sometimes a very new person who's very ethical and has a lot of integrity can act as a model and can support colleagues to challenge things or to question things that they otherwise might not feel able to.
And these are all skills, actually, Jerry, that we need in our work with children and adults and families. But one of the things that we'd really like to do with you now is to think about how to have that difficult conversation. And I'm just going to walk through some of the steps that are very helpful in preparing for difficult conversations. And when you're giving feedback on performance, you need to follow a few steps even before you start to talk to someone. It's really important that you establish exactly what is happening, how the person is behaving, and what evidence you have of this. The second thing is that you really need to understand your role in the situation. How are you impacting on the behaviour? Thirdly, you need to seek support to ensure that it's appropriate for you to raise the issue and that you have a really sound plan for how to do this. And once you're confident that there is an issue and that you should be the person to raise it, you need to arrange to speak to the member of staff. This interview is often described, particularly in Toni Morrison's work, as the bridging interview. And it's because you're trying to bridge the gap between the expectations that we have and what's actually happening in practice. Really, in this interview, you should expect to learn about the interviewee and you should expect to learn about their context and their experience. If you actually don't learn anything new from the conversation, it's unlikely that it's been as helpful to you or to the other person as it could have been. Before you talk to the person, you really need to ask yourself a few questions. Is this person aware of the expectations? And what are the expectations and how do they compare to usual practice? Does the person have the necessary capabilities to actually meet these expectations? Does the person have the confidence and support to meet the expectations? And once again, going back to what is the evidence of this? And in particular, being able to give really good concrete examples of exactly what it is that is concerning and where those gaps are so that people can learn through it. Jerry spoke at the beginning about the manager sitting down and going through step by step all of the actions. And it's really, you know, helping ground that stuff that's very helpful. You really need to understand whether these issues have ever been raised before. And if they have been, what was the person's response? How are they going to hear you if this has been raised before? And then you need to be really, really clear about what you want to achieve. And not only what you want to achieve as a manager, but what you want for the person. And one of the things about this type of work is that you're wanting to enable someone to do the best work they can and be the best person they can be. And that means that you're really trying to step off on a positive foot. So when you explain your concerns nice and clearly, it's then time to ask the interviewee what they think about that and to give them lots of space to actually respond and to be prepared for the fact that they might be shocked, they might be surprised, it might be a distressing conversation, and allow for that emotion to come into the room and let the person not feel judged about it. This conversation does take some time, and you might need to come back to the discussion again and again. A person might need additional support, and you know something, you might need some too.
Yeah, and it's the same sort of skills that we use with service users and carers that we work with, isn't it? And it's whether that's because of something that they're doing or something that's happening to them, but it's a difficult topic that you're trying to raise in a sensitive way and being really aware that you might have missed or misunderstood. There might be a completely different explanation or something else going on that you're not aware of, but coming at it with the evidence and the respect. The other thing that we really wanted to talk about was communities of practice. Communities of practice were kind of identified by Wenger, and they were identified as a way that people learn together. So he did work looking at how apprentices learned a trade. And what's helpful about thinking about community practice is that it's a model of how you can get purposeful peer support. So a community practice is an informal group that people form to achieve a shared purpose. So the purpose is to do something. So there's a practice, there's something that people want to be able to do well. And people come together because they have an interest in that. And it may be that they come together in a location or a particular role, or in a particular with a particular problem in mind, and they may form and then disperse and so on. But the thing that supports them is the shared goal and an awareness that being part of the community will help them to achieve the goal. So members of the community produce knowledge about how to achieve the goal as they undertake activities. And through activities such as discussion, reflection, practice, doing things, creating artifacts, creating resources, tools and things like that, they gradually advance the knowledge of the group so that everybody benefits and everybody gets closer to achieving the goal. So an example of this would be a group of social workers coming together to talk about a particular practice issue, to share their experiences, to share different tools or different resources or different ways of working that they've tried out, and to keep coming back to learn from each other and to improve each other's practice. Being part of the community isn't just about advancing your knowledge, it's also about getting emotional support from feeling like belonging. And one of the issues that we find with communities of practice is that they're very supportive to people who are members, but they can also be exclusive if you're not careful. So keeping the boundaries of the community open, allowing new people in, allowing people in who are different roles, who may be from a different agency, not having a kind of sense of professional separation, but wanting to learn from others can be really important. And as you welcome others and meet them, you get a very rich source of learning across boundaries. So that's why multidisciplinary teams, for example, can be really positive places to advance practice. And where you have colleagues who are isolated, having an informal community of practice can be really, really necessary, because we do need opportunities to talk with people who understand what we're trying to achieve and what we're experiencing, and those sorts of relationships can give us confidence to test ideas out and challenge each other and question what's happening. One of the marks of a good relationship in our personal lives is the ability to kind of fall out and make up, and that's equally important with your professional lives, and it's a really good thing again to be able to model to the people that we work with. The only other thing I wanted to say about this is that you can find that there's some people who have a natural ability to bring people together into communities or to span boundaries between communities, and sometimes those people can be a bit separate because they have a slightly different function. So a manager might be a bit separate, or somebody who works across two kind of professions might be a bit separate. And making sure that you include those kind of people who are facilitators or sometimes called boundary spanners, which is a terrible expression, I think, can be really, really useful in gaining the resource. And again, it stops you from being too exclusive.
That gives me a lot to think about, actually, Jerry. I've got to say, that little idea. And in a way, we're kind of trying to make a community of practice, aren't we? That's what we're doing with the podcasts, and hoping that we can generate discussion and ideas and feedback as we kind of spin things out there.
It would be nice to think, wouldn't it, that there's groups of people around the place getting together and talking about social work and about challenge, using all of these artifacts, whether it's a podcast or a resource. Yeah. I mean, that's going on, but for it to be a matter of curiosity and relationship and not just, I have to learn for my job.
Yeah, no, a real conscious act of empowerment. And I think that kind of comes back to, why challenge is so important. And it's because people who need social work need us to be supported so that we can be effective. I don't know why I said affected there, except that I was kind of thinking about the fact that if we are affected by the difficulties and the struggles of the work that we're doing, we become preoccupied and then we become unavailable. And once that happens to us, we actually become ineffectual. And how we behave with colleagues, particularly ones who we perceive to be more powerful than us or less powerful than us, really influences how we behave with children, adults, and families. And we need to see interaction and challenge with our colleagues as part of our practice.
Mm. As a healthy thing.
And as a really healthy thing. I think, if you think about your own practice and ask yourself, when was the last time somebody challenged you? Because actually, are you really not in need of any challenge?
Oh, I can use my quote, which is the John Stuart Mill's one.
Yeah.
That if you only know your own side of the argument, then you don't even know that.
Yes, which I think is a really, great point for us to reflect upon. How many sides to the arguments do you understand? And, do you have the habit of being curious?
Mm.
Do you have the habit of seeking out challenge? And do you challenge the abuse of power?
That's a great place to finish.
Okay.
Thanks, Jo.
Thanks. See you later.